Writer's Way, a Right Attitude radio show. This program is brought to you by the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative that enhances student learning by fostering positive attitudes toward writing. I am your host, Dee Dee Botticelli. Today, we'll focus on the work of Canadian author Lawrence Hill. We'll hear from Lawrence Hill himself reading from one of his novels, and we'll listen to an interview he gave while visiting Savannah State University in 2014. In the second half of the show, we'll hear poetry and prose written by Savannah State students, tying in a number of themes featured in Hill's work.
I'm Lawrence Hill, and I'm reading from my novel, The Book of Negroes, and this is from the first chapter, which is called And Now I Am Old. I seem to have trouble dying. By all rights, I should not have lived this long. But I can still smell trouble riding on any wind, just as surely as I could tell you whether it is a stew of chicken necks or pig's feet bubbling in the iron pot on the fire. And my ears still work just as good as a hound dog's. People assume that just because you don't stand straight as a sapling, you're deaf, or that your mind is like pumpkin mush. The other day, when I was being led into a meeting with a bishop, one of the society ladies told another, "We must get this woman into Parliament soon. Who knows how much longer she'll be with us?" Half bent though I was, I dug my fingers into her ribs. She let out a shriek and spun around to face me. "Careful," I told her, "I may outlast you." There must be a reason why I've lived in all these lands, survived all those water crossings, while others fell from bullets or shut their eyes and simply willed their lives to end. In the earliest days, when I was free and knew nothing other, I used to sneak outside our walled compound, climb straight up the acacia tree while balancing Father's Koran on my head, sit way out on a branch and wonder how I might one day unlock all the mysteries contained in the book. Feet swinging beneath me, I would put down the book, the only one I'd seen in Bayeux, and look out at the patchwork of mud walls and thatched coverings. People were always on the move. Women carrying water from the river, men working iron in the fires, boys returning triumphant from the forest with snared porcupines. It's a lot of work, extracting meat from a porcupine, but if they had no other pressing chores, they would do it anyway, removing the quills, skinning the animal, slicing out the innards, practicing with their sharp knives on the pathetic little carcasses. In those days I felt free and happy, and the very idea of safety never intruded on my thoughts. I have escaped violent endings even as they have surrounded me, but I never had the privilege of holding on to my children, living with them, raising them the way my own parents raised me for 10 or 11 years, until all of our lives were torn asunder. I never managed to keep my own children long, which explains why they are not here with me now, making my meals, adding straw to my bedding, bringing me a cape to hold off the cold, sitting with me by the fire with the knowledge that they had emerged from my loins and that our shared moments had grown like cornstalks in damp soil. Others take care of me now, and that's a fine thing, but it's not the same as having one's own flesh and blood to cradle one toward the grave. I long to hold my own children, and their children, if they exist, and I miss them the way I'd miss limbs from my own body. They have me exceedingly busy here in London. They say I'm to meet King George. About me, I have a clutch of abolitionists, big-whiskered, wide-bellied, bald-headed men boycotting sugar but smelling of tobacco and burning candle after candle as they plot deep into the night. The abolitionists say that they've brought me to England to help them change the course of history. Well, we shall see about that, but if I've lived this long, it must be for a reason. Fa means father in my language. Ba means river. It also means mother. In my early childhood, my ba was like a river, flowing on and on and on with me through the days and keeping me safe at night. Most of my lifetime has come and gone, but I still think of them as my parents, older and wiser than I, and still hear their voices, sometimes deep-chested, at other moments floating like musical notes. I imagine their hands steering me from trouble, guiding me around cooking fires and leading me to the mat in the cool shade of our home. I can still picture my father with a sharp stick over hard earth, scratching out Arabic in flowing lines and speaking of the distant Timbuktu. In private moments, when the abolitionists are not swirling about like tornadoes, seeking my presence in this deputation or my signature atop that petition. I wish my parents were still here to care for me. Isn't that strange? Here I am, a broken-down old black woman who's crossed more water than I care to remember, and walked more leagues than a workhorse, and the only things I dream of are things I can't have, children and grandchildren to love, and parents to care for me. The other day they took me into a London school and had me talk to the children. One girl asked if it was true that I was the famous Mina Dee, the one mentioned in all the newspapers. Her parents, she said, did not believe that I could have lived in so many places. I acknowledged that I was Mina Dee, but that she could call me Aminatal Diallo if she wanted, which was my childhood name. We worked on my first name for a while. After 3 tries, she got it. Aminata, 4 syllables. It's really not that hard. Aminata, I told her. She said she wished I could meet her parents and her grandparents. I replied that it amazed me that she still had grandparents in her life. Love them good, I told her, and love them big. Love them every day. She asked why I was so black. I asked why she was so white. She said she was born that way. Same here, I replied. I can see that you must have been quite pretty, even though you are so very dark, she said. You would be prettier if London ever got any sun, I replied. She asked what I ate. My grandfather says he bets you eat raw elephant. I told her I'd never actually taken a bite out of an elephant, but there had been times in my life when I was hungry enough to try. I chased 300 or 400 of them in my life, but never managed to get one to stop rampaging through villages and stand still long enough for me to take a good bite. She laughed and said she wanted to know what I really ate. I eat what you eat, I told her. Do you suppose I'm going to find an elephant walking about the streets of London? Sausages, eggs, mutton stew, bread, crocodiles, all those regular things. Crocodiles, she said. I told her I was just checking to see if she was listening. She said she was an excellent listener and wanted me to please tell her a ghost story. Honey, I said, my life is a ghost story. Then tell it to me, she said. As I told her, I am Aminata Diallo, daughter of Mamadou Diallo and Sira Koulibaly, born in the village of Bayo, 3 miles by foot from the grain coast in West Africa. I am a Bamana and a Fula. I am both, and will explain that later.
You've just listened to Lawrence Hill reading from the opening chapter of his 2007 novel, The Book of Negroes. This novel won a host of prizes, including the Roger Writers Trust Fiction Prize, the Commonwealth Writers Prize for Best Book, and both CBC Canada Reads and Radio Canada's Combat des Livres. A television miniseries based on The Book of Negroes aired in the United States on BET in 2015 as well.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yaunt, the director of the Right Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
Hello, this is Kiara King from the Savannah State Writing Center. College professors expect that students will be able to ask for help when they need it. If you are unaware about what an assignment is asking you to do, take the time to meet with your instructor. All professors have office hours, which are usually listed in the syllabus. Be proactive and make a plan to get the help that you need.
The Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Writer's Way with your host, Dee Dee Botticelli. Today we are focusing on Lawrence Hill, critically acclaimed Canadian author. Lawrence Hill is the son of American immigrants who came to Canada the day after they married in 1953. Growing up in Ontario in the 60s, Hill was greatly influenced by his parents' work in the human rights movement. Much of Hill's work touches on issues of identity and belonging. He is the author of 9 books, and in 2013, Hill wrote the nonfiction book Blood, The Stuff of Life, which formed the basis of his 2013 Massey Lectures. Let's sit back and listen to an interview with Hill that was recorded during his visit to Savannah State University in 2014.
Hello, I'm Darylena Natera, and we're here with esteemed author Lawrence Hill. He's the author of 9 books, including The Book of Negroes, the winner of various awards, including the Commonwealth Writers' Prize, the Rogers Writers' Trust Fiction Prize, and both the English and French-Canadian versions of CBC Radio's Canada Reads. He traveled across Canada to deliver the 2013 Massey Lectures based on his new nonfiction book, Blood, The Stuff of Life. He is finishing a new novel and has co-written the adaptation for a 6-part television miniseries of The Book of Negroes. The miniseries was filmed in South Africa and Nova Scotia and will air in 2015 on CBC in Canada and on BET in the United States. He volunteers with Crossroads International, book clubs for inmates, and with the Black Loyalties Heritage Society. He lives in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. This is Mr. Lawrence Hill. Thank you for joining us today.
I'm happy to, dear Lena.
How are you today?
Just great, thank you. First visit to Savannah State University. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. It is my understanding that you have visited Savannah previously, though.
I have. I came here when I was researching the Book of Negroes, or someone knows my name as it's known for the time being in the States. And yes, it's a gorgeous, fascinating city.
Where exactly did you visit in the area?
Well, I spent a lot of time walking around the city, you know, going through bookstores, picking up histories, especially African-American histories in Georgia and Savannah, so in the downtown area.
What parts of did you gather from Savannah that you were able to use in your book?
As it turns out, nothing, because at the time that I was researching, I thought that I might set some of it in Georgia, but I finally decided to set the early part of the novel in St. Helena Island, one of the sea islands off the coast of South Carolina. So not too far away, because it's the very southern tip of South Carolina. But I finally decided that the part that I would set down here would be in South Carolina and not Savannah. So I didn't end up using that research. However, I have a novel on the go just now that I've just begun. And some of that will take place on Cumberland Island, which is an island off the coast of the Georgia coast. And so I'll be back for more research.
So a lot of close ties to Savannah.
Mm-hmm.
Were you able to use some of the Gullah Geechee history in your novel?
Very much so. In the novel, the character comes as a young girl. Her first experience in the Americas is to come work on an indigo plantation in St. Helena Island, which is one of the sea islands. It's not far from Hilton Head Island. So I really dug into that a lot, and I went off into that part of the world too when I was researching the book. It was great fun, fascinating. I learned a great deal.
Great deal, awesome. So can you describe your writing process to us?
Well, sure. My writing process is, my first work as a writer was to be a journalist. I wrote for newspapers in Canada as a daily newspaper reporter. So I learned to write fast. And the novels I've written generally are pretty long and complex, so I'd never write them if I was going too slowly. So I tend to be a bit explosive on the page to begin. I just try to look for some sort of volcanic eruption and just let the energy spill onto the page and then come back and I rewrite a great deal. So I write sort of fast and loose and explosively on first draft and then I rewrite.
You spoke in the lecture that you just came from. You said that you spent some time in Spain where you strictly wrote. How was that? It was kind of, it reminded me of like the eat, pray, love, you know, finding mm-hmm. yourself. How was that experience in Spain and how did that affect your writing process?
It was totally liberating, actually, and I will forever love Spain because it became a place where I became a writer. And my feeling is you're not a writer if you won a prize or if you've become famous or if you've sold 1 million books. What makes you a writer is if you're writing. And I mean, one of the most famous writers of the 20th century was Franz Kafka, the author of Metamorphosis, and he died before any of his works were known in the public. But now he's one of the most famous writers ever produced by the 20th century. So was he not a writer because he wasn't published when he was alive? Of course he was a writer, he just wasn't published. So what defines you, I think, as a writer is that you were writing. And the thing that I love so much about Spain is that, well, apart from the language and just the culture, is that it gave me a place to really find myself as a writer. So I quit my job as a newspaper reporter and lived off my savings and just wrote every day around the clock. And so I found myself as a writer in Spain and began to really tap into those creative, you know, energies. So I love the country, but one of the reasons that it led me to the heart of who I really need to be creatively, you know, an artist.
What, I know you write nonfiction and fiction, but does Kafka inspire you in any way to maybe explore the surrealism? Have you ever thought about this?
Well, I haven't really written in a surreal vein before, but Kafka inspires me tremendously. And of course, not everything he does is like Metamorphosis, where the main character turns into a bug, and The Trial, which is a really powerful story. I don't seem to recall that there's any surreal element to The Trial. It's just a really powerful story about, you know, political and social oppression. And so Kafka does inspire me profoundly, as of course do many other writers. I mean, you can be taught by your teachers, but you're also taught by other writers, many of whom were dead a long time before you were born. And I feel I learn from them every day, no matter when they lived.
All right. How do you choose a theme for a story? What?
Well, I mean, it's dangerous for novelists, or at least I find it dangerous to think in terms of theme, because the last thing a reader wants is to be preached to and be told what's what, you know, like nobody wants to have life explained to them when they're reading. They want to be entertained, and if there's some learning along the way, they want that to be sort of between the lines or almost accidental, as opposed to now you're going to take your medicine and learn this history or something. So to think too openly in terms of themes is really dangerous for a novelist, because then you can get preachy awfully fast and turn off the reader. So I find that it's more helpful to think in terms of drama, character, plot, you know, what kind of characters excite me, what are they going to do, how do I put them in, you know, in action, what kind of struggles will they have. The essence of plot, the essence of drama, is to create a crisis for your main character and then to make it get worse and worse and worse. So things should start bad and they should get worse. So that's really how I kind of align my thoughts when I'm beginning to write. Plot and character rather than theme.
Where did your inspiration for the Book of Negroes come from?
Well, I read a long time before writing it that this unbelievable migration of blacks from New York City to Nova Scotia at the end of the American Revolution, having had their names inscribed into this British naval ledger called the Book of Negroes, and then how 10 years later they turned around and left Nova Scotia, Canada, on the east coast of Canada, and sailed to across the Atlantic to found the colony of Freetown in Sierra Leone. So the inspiration was sort of hitting upon these two unbelievably striking journeys. And how is it that here we are in 2014 and most North Americans still don't know anything about these histories? And I find it fascinating that there are still huge untold or unknown or underappreciated stories about our own history. So in a way, I was kind of lucky that it's not well known, because it gave me room to come up the middle with a novel and then a television miniseries. And so, yeah, it's amazing to think that we have all these histories that we still don't know, and that still leave us room to dramatize and to excite people about things they are happy to learn about that they'd never heard of before.
I completely can relate to that. Being at an HBCU, a lot of times, it will be the first time that a lot of us are having these discussions in our classrooms of our history, and it's really, you know, frightening to me that, you know, my peers were also blind to a lot of the history that's, a lot of it's in our face and we just don't know to recognize what we're looking at. But I really enjoyed the aspect of your novel. How, your novels are so in depth, like how long do you research to actually, before you get to the writing process, or do you do that during the writing process? How does that work?
Well, because I'm fundamentally lazy, I'm afraid that if I just research, I'll never get any work done, and it's a great pretext to do no work. And so I force myself to start writing as soon as a book begins, and not to say, oh, I'll just research for a year in a library and then I'll start to write. So I make myself start writing from day one and research simultaneously. So the writing comes, and that's because often the better ideas that I come up with, they're not sort of planted, or they don't sort of present themselves to me when I'm sitting, you know, scratching my chin around the table wondering what will I do with this story. They come while I'm writing. They actually are born as a process of, as a kind of a byproduct of the writing process. So I just get writing to sort of help me discover what my story will be. So it's messy and sloppy, and it's, sometimes I have no idea where I'm going, but it's a writing that leads me to the answers on a second or a third or a fourth draft. So I research and write simultaneously, and this book, The Book of Negroes, took 5 years. So that includes researching and writing time and editing and all that.
Okay. How do you, like, wind down to finish a project? Because you can get so, you know...
Well, maybe by the time you're sick of it, after 8 drafts, I just can't do anymore. Maybe when my editor says, okay, I'm happy now. So, because in the last draft or two, you've got an editor who's on your case, who's saying, you can do better. You know, what about the bridge between chapter 20 and 21? Can you not write a better bridge? Is that ending strong enough? You know, do you have too many characters walking around the first 50 pages? Do you need to simplify, move the reader more quickly into the story in the first 50 pages? What can you do to improve? And so when she's satisfied, that's a good sign that it's kind of ready to go to market too.
Okay. Your parents are immigrants who immigrated to Canada in the 1953. Your dad is black and your mom is white. They both worked in the human rights movement. How does did your parents' ideas and examples influence your work? How do they...
Well, totally, profoundly. Maybe not specifically the Book of Negroes or the specific books I've written, but I've been inspired by everything they represented and stood for and did. I say sort of jokingly that there are two types of people in the world, a type who completely throws off the values of their parents and forges an entirely new direction because they reject, in a way, many of their parents' values and create their own. And that's perfectly legitimate, sometimes entirely necessary. And other people who really embrace their parents' values, and I'm in the latter category. I've embraced my parents' values and their vision, you know, their social drive, their desire to make a better world. I didn't take on the work that they did. I didn't spend my life as a sociologist or as a human rights activist. I'm a writer, but I've certainly embraced their values on the page and in my own living from day to day.
How do you teach your children about the black experience, being biracial? How do you approach that when it comes to your children?
Funny, you know, that's an interesting word, biracial, and I've never really used it that much to think of myself. I've just sort of, when I've had to think about it, you know, when you know how it is, when you're brushing your teeth in the morning, you're not thinking about your racial identity. You have to think about it when somebody brings it to your attention and makes it an issue, whether somebody's asking about it or it comes up in some way. But you don't necessarily go there naturally when you're going about your day-to-day living. And so I guess maybe because the primary family identification we had was black, most of my mother's family turned away from her when she chose a black man as a husband, with one key exception, which was her twin sister who loved her all along. But most of the family that we had connections with was the African-American side of the family. We didn't have much connection at all, almost zero, with the other side. So it was only natural that in my case, I sort of leaned towards a sense of black identity as I was moving into an age when you'd think about those things. I wrote a book about it about 13 years ago called Blackberry Sweet Juice on Being Black and White in Canada. So it's a book about forging a sense of identity as a child and young adult with two parents of different backgrounds. But I don't usually think of myself as biracial. I generally think of myself as black if push comes to shove and I'm asked to think about it. And how do I teach my children about black identity and perhaps about black culture, black history? Well, I teach it by embracing it in my own life, in my work, and in two of my volunteer gigs that I've been involved with for many years. Well, one I've been involved with for 35 years as a volunteer with this group that does work with women and girls in sub-Saharan Africa. So they see me do this work as a writer and as a community volunteer. We talk, you know, at all the kitchen table talk, but just naturally about different aspects of black history and black culture. So part of it is just easy talk, you know, father to child, and part of it is through example. And part of it is through introduction, introducing them to worlds where they can connect in their own way with African culture. And my eldest daughter, who's 24, who finished university a couple years ago, she's just come back from working for 2 years in Ghana as a volunteer and came home declaring that she's going to spend her life in Africa. And she's not done with it, and it's not done with her. So far, the job's going pretty well because she's certainly embracing profoundly everything that's African about her background.
How do you feel about people who are against labels such as African American? Raymond Simone recently sat down with Oprah, and she declared that she did not want to be labeled as African American. She just wanted to be American.
Well, I mean, James Baldwin said the same thing. James Baldwin hated being identified as an African American writer, and clearly he was profoundly African American in his writing, in his meditations, in his essays, in his novels. James Baldwin was a fiery, you know, dramatist and essayist about things African American. But he didn't like to be called an African American novelist because he felt it diminished him. He just wanted to be called an American novelist. You know, one of his contemporaries and rivals was Norman Mailer, who got to be called an American novelist. So Baldwin felt that being called an African American novelist made him sort of a second class American novelist. He just wanted to be an American novelist who wrote about African themes. I think that every individual should have the right to decide how they want to identify themselves, and I don't think it's my business if you or my daughter or our friend or a student here or there chooses. Why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't people in this day and age choose to sort of fashion an identity that works for them? And indeed, even in the same family, when I researched that book, Blackberry Sweet Juice, on being black and white in Canada, what I did was I interviewed 34 other Canadians who, like me, had one black and one white parent. Sometimes I'd interview siblings, and those siblings wouldn't all see matters of race and self-identity the same way. And why should they? Why should every sibling in the family, same socioeconomic background, same education, why should they see themselves the same way? It's a good thing that they don't. And so I don't want to impose my way of thinking on other people because I'm right and they're wrong. But for me, I think that it would be kind of unrealistic to pretend that I don't care about those terms, or to pretend that they have no weight. The fact is that out there in the world, they have weight every day, and you'll encounter it every day, or you could encounter it every day, depending on how you live. And so you can say as much as you want that these terms don't have any meaning and you won't use them, but they will crop up and affect people in a very practical, real way, sometimes a very negative way, throughout their experiences in school and in the workforce, socially. So I don't think you can get away from the reality, even if we'd like to change that reality.
Welcome back. We now return you to the second half of the interview with Lawrence Hill.
So we were speaking about Raven Simone and Oprah, but speaking of Oprah, the Book of Negroes was selected by the Oprah Magazine as the 2010 top summer read, and you just came from, do you mind sharing with us?
I just came from Cannes, a film festival in southern France on the Mediterranean. It's the festival is called MIPCOM, and it's a festival of television shows that will be airing, you know, sometime soon. So it's a big trade fair, and so the Book of Negroes premiered a couple of days ago in Cannes. So it was the first time it was shown on the big screen with people in the audience, and it was great. It was a lot of fun. And since I co-wrote it, it was particularly thrilling to see this kind of come to life on the screen.
That's awesome. And that is starring Louis Gossett Jr. and Cuba Gooding Jr. and will be airing on BET. How do you feel about, you know, having one of your works come to life?
It's really exciting, and I really want to mention the female lead too, because I find that often, you know, African American women kind of get left behind, you know, in the credits, and the lead character is a woman. The actor's name is Ingenue Ellis from Mississippi. Terrific. She was in The Help, and now she's in this, and she's been in all sorts of other shows. She did a great job. I feel great. It's really exciting. I mean, it's a novelist's dream, not only to have their novel come out and attract attention, but also to see it transformed into another medium to reach people in another way. It's great. Yeah, and plus I learned a lot in co-writing it.
The leading character is a woman. So how was that writing from a woman's perspective, and how do you develop your characters, because they're so in-depth and so detailed? What's your feeling?
Well, I just try to relax and use my imagination and believe and kind of probe and see where things go, let loose, write quickly. I find that if I'm going quickly, my imagination fires and I relax more. And If you've ever watched a 100-meter dash from the Olympic Games being replayed in slow motion, you notice that the athletes' faces who are sprinting, the fastest sprinters in the world, their faces are completely elastic. And in slow motion, you see their lips and their cheeks flying up and down. And they're so relaxed, which is kind of paradoxical, because they have to relax to be the fastest runners in the world. You wouldn't think that's the case, but they do. And I think writing is the same. You have to relax in order to really find something playful and vibrant and quirky and unusual, surprising, fresh. So relaxing, for me, is attained by writing so quickly that it just feels like breathing, that I'm not self-conscious about it. So that's one of the biggest things, just kind of sit down and let it rip and see what kind of bubbles up on the page. Then you can go back and rework it time and time again after.
You have a Trek background, so that's a nice metaphor for your writing. I like it. Your novel, The Book of Negroes, was published under several different names. Can we talk about how the American audience and how the publishers didn't feel?
Sure. Well, the book is published primarily around the English-speaking word world as the Book of Negroes, which is the name of this ledger that documents the exodus of 3,000 African Americans to Nova Scotia in 1783. This ledger was kept by the British Navy, who are documenting all the people who are leaving New York for Nova Scotia, Canada. So it's a real document. You find it in the New York City Public Library and at Colonial Williamsburg and in Washington, D.C. at the National Archives. In the originals, in the National Archives of the United Kingdom in London. So the book is called The Book of Negroes because it was central to the story of Aminata, the main character. But the American publisher at the last minute felt that they couldn't bring out this book 7 years ago with the word Negroes in the title. Bookstores wouldn't order it, pre-order it with the word Negroes. They felt that it might offend an African-American readership. And so it sort of entered the world with two different titles, one for the States and one for most of the rest of the English-speaking world. And when I've toured in the States all over, whether it's Atlanta or Beaufort, you know, South Carolina, or Brooklyn, Chicago, Boston, often African Americans have come up to me and have said, it's a good thing you changed that title, because down here I wouldn't have bought that book if it had been called The Book of Negroes, because that really bothers me, that title. And it's given me a chance to tell people about the title, the Canadian title, and where it came from, and then I'm trying to kind of resurrect a forgotten document and bring it to public attention, respectfully, not provocatively. We'll see how it goes. When BET releases a miniseries, the publisher will re-release under the original title, so we'll see how the American market responds. But one thing's for sure, it'll provoke conversation and discussion, and that's a good thing.
And can we talk about the connection between your character, how naming, you know, in the Gullah Geechee culture, names are very important.
Yes.
And it's, you know, you touch on it in your book, so then that happens with the publishing of your book.
Yes. So. Well, in the United States, the book's called Someone Knows My Name, and part of that was to lift my hat in recognition of the work by James Baldwin, who wrote Nobody Knows My Name many decades ago, but also it's to celebrate the idea that the name is so central to African identity, you know, coming into the new world. And if you want to strip a person of their dignity or their self-pride, you take their name away, you don't let them use their name. And it's a real effective way to attack a person's self-concept and not let them have their name anymore. And it was very deliberate and cruel on the part of slave owners and others in colonial America and Canada, too. And so Someone Knows My Name is a phrase that's uttered on the slave vessel when Aminata, the main character, finds this boy that who's kind of fallen for her. I mean, they're still children, but in a way they have a love already, even though they're still children, a platonic love between them. And she goes to see him in the slave vessel, and he's in terrible straits, and he's in chains, and she says his name, and he feels uplifted. He feels that his humanity is recognized, because even in the worst possible situation, he's been stolen from his continent, he's chained in a slave vessel, somebody says his name, and that uplifts him for a minute and makes him feel like a human being again. So Someone Knows My Name is very central to the concept of naming and identity and self-pride.
In your other novel, Blood, The Stuff of Life, talks about blood, a subject that a lot of people, you know, doesn't usually make table conversation.
No, but it should. Why not? Now, Blood, the Stuff of Life isn't a novel. It's an essay. It's a nonfiction book. But it's a book about the various ways that we see blood in ourselves. In what way does our self-concept as a woman, as a man, as a person of a certain racial background, of a certain religious background, of a national background, in what way does blood feed into our sense of identity? And I think it feeds in profoundly, but it's something we don't discuss too much, but it's central to how we see ourselves. And also blood, men and women traditionally have very different notions of their own blood. I mean, for men, traditionally, for the millennia, blood was something to be spilled as a trophy of sport or war. You know, it was a sign of one's glory on the battlefield or in sport. And for women, it was a monthly sign of their fertility. You know, blood is very different often, and has been treated very differently over thousands of years among the two sexes. And so I think that's fascinating, too. So there's much to say about blood and identity, and so I went there in this set of essays that I wrote last year.
And you touch on the two instances that really sparked your fascination with blood in your novel. Can you share with us?
Are you talking about the childhood incident?
Yeah.
Well, in one case, I was a young boy. I was, I don't know, 6 or 7, and I was playing hide and seek on a schoolyard, and I accidentally cut my wrist very badly. My wrist came down on an open piece of glass from a broken beer bottle that I hadn't seen, and so my wrist was lacerated, and I was bleeding profusely. It was not your regular childhood cut, you know, where you slap a Band-Aid on and you're fine. So I knew something was really wrong. So I ran home screaming, of course, and even in my state of anxiety and worry and hollering for my mother, I made sure that my blood splashed on every single sidewalk panel as I ran up the street to my house. And you know how those sidewalk panels are about 1 or 2 yards long? I wanted an unbroken stream of blood on every panel right up to my front door. Well, why would a 7-year-old boy do that? I mean, for me, that's fascinating. Like, I knew somewhere deep inside myself, even in my state of shock and panic and fear, that blood was sacred to me, and the stuff of my own life was spilling out on the sidewalk. This was my life spilling out on the sidewalk, and somehow I thought that was sacred, so I wanted to mark the sidewalk with my sacred fluid. And so the anecdote is revealing to me because it taught me, as I reflected back, just how profoundly blood enters into the psyche of a person as a kind of a metaphor for our own life. More than any other bodily part or bodily fluid, blood is really defines our imagination about ourselves.
Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
I appreciate you. And again, the mini-series, The Book of Negroes, will be airing on BET. Do you have a date for that?
2015, early 2015.
Early 15. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed that.
We've just listened to an interview with Lawrence Hill, conducted by Diorlena Natera, a Savannah State student in mass communications. For the next portion of our show, we'll play several original pieces written by Savannah State students, all of which were inspired by the themes featured in Hill's work.
Hello, my name is Justin Cossey. I'm a junior at Savannah State University, majoring in English, and the poem that I will be reciting today is an original piece entitled Not Guilty. We young black and oppressed. Do y'all believe all that shit in the press? They let us kill each other. All we care about is squeezing a tech. The only way you get respect is if you toting a vest. Put 3 in your chest. 3 shots from Officer Wilson. Killed Michael Brown and never stepped foot in a prison. It's part of their mission. I'm giving you wisdom. I think you should listen. Kill many blacks and we put the rest of them in prisons. Shit. What is the cost of a black man's life? Check the toe tag. It's not 1-0 in sight. The revolution's televised, we never finished the fight. It's 2015 and we still battle for rights. Shit, what is the cost of a black man's life? If it's fueled by a white man's strife, if he's stabbed with a white man's knife, he disobeys one white man's rights, and that's the end of that black man's life. Excuse me, sir, what is the cost of a black man's life? A black man ain't got no rights. A black man ain't earned no stripes. So what's the cost of a black man's life? A bag of chips and a $4 Sprite. That's one hell of a life. This is the truth, no matter how they try to fight it. Kill a child and don't even get indicted. Who decided evidence wasn't clear enough? Home of the sheep, only in America.
Hello, my name is Erica Thomas, and I'm an English major at Savannah State University. Today, I'll be reading a fellow student of mine, Tom Bennett's, title, That's Just Life. who's also an English major. That's just life growing up without my mother. That's just life how my grandma became my mother. That's just life when my pops got run over by his truck. That's just life how he survived. That's just life how my pops was in and out of jail. That's just life how those situations matured me. That's just life. That's just life when my brother got his weed laced. That's just life he will never be the same. That's just life that he still smokes weed to this day. That's just life. That's just life when you have to provide for your family. That's just life when you've been doing that since you were 13. That's just life. That's just life when you can only play the hand you were dealt. That's just life that sometimes the dice doesn't roll your way. That's just life when you go for the 2-point conversion and fall short. That's just life. That's just life when the weight of the world is on your shoulders. That's just life when your back is against the wall. That's just life when your feet is sinking in quicksand. That's just life. That's just life when we all have to leave this earth not knowing the day or time, heaven or hell. But hey, that's just life.
Hi, my name is Janae Waring. I'm a senior here at Savannah State and an English major. I'll be reading Poetry of the Souls of the Lost. Trusting in the life that the Silver Spoon high-stepping squadron laid before me, surpassing all their wildest nightmares, focusing on my own demise. Looking at the ongoing street tyrants leading to their own drum, no leaders, just the constant bellowing of musical innuendo. Teaching young men to stand with arms and forget about promises they made before they became grown men. Taunting the dream that was laid before them, forgetting who fought before them. Musical annihilation, ruining minds all around. Young girls tainted by their own hips and curves, trying to walk into the weave shops trying to be something they're not. I stay hidden in them alleyways of dark clouds that stay focused on taking me out. Congested and choking on the crap that's taught to us. Confused on what's part of my experience in reality. Subjected to false realities set me on a freedom fight. Who will fight with a lonely girl who looks in the mirror and doesn't recognize the monster looking back? Painted faces that no longer resemble ancestors before me. Barely holding on to the message that constantly has me reverting to old ways. But then, those soldiers come for you, tearing at your innocence.
Hi, my name is Quianna Levant. I am an English major here at Savannah State University, where I'm also a senior, and I will be reading an untitled poem. Eyes wide open, full of hope and joy, not young nor old, head filled with dreams of acceptance, but soon to be shut closed, only seeing darkness, darker than the mole that rests on my shoulder, the ground painted red from shattered dreams of equal love, feeling the blows like bombs going off in the street, shattered bones like broken glass all over the place, a hand broken apart and a kiss that brought rage. Isn't love all the same at the end of the day? Love is kind and love is sweet. It has no rules of stipulations, but the swing of a punch stopped your kiss and the kick at your knee tore your hands apart. Rules were set that night and you were forced to obey, but tomorrow you will live to kiss another day.
You have just listened to poetry by Justin Cossey, Tom Bennett, read by Erica Thomas, Janae Warings, and Kiana Levant. As you can tell, Hill's work inspires a connection with identity, history, and race. Join me now as we listen to more of students' original works.
My name is Candace Reynolds. I'm a graduating senior and a mass communications major. I'll be reading my poem entitled, The Place That Doesn't Exist. There's a place that I can describe, yet this place doesn't exist. I never heard of this place, but I've traveled there plenty of times. It's all in my head. I know it's in there somewhere. These contradictions that I cannot see, emotions that I've witnessed. Only a woman can understand this place, only where a woman will be. But even she can't comprehend. This notion cheers her and puts her in a deep depression. She will present this place to you when you make her mad. She assures she's found that place before. Only you can make her find it. Wait, it's gone again. Nothing remains of it. All it ever was a blank instinct and a question mark.
My name is Candace Reynolds. I am a graduating senior and mass communications major. I'll be reading a poem by my fellow senior classmate, Kiara Lewis, entitled, She Was Somebody. She was somebody who made dirt pies. She was somebody who got grass stains on her blue jeans. She was somebody with scraped knees riding bikes handless. She was somebody who cried when her nappy roots were combed. She was somebody. She was somebody whose hips spread like rumors. She was somebody who traded in gym shorts for a mini skirt. She was somebody whose red lipstick latched to her full lips. She was somebody with the lustful aroma of Chanel perfume. She was somebody. She was somebody whose kisses were free spirits. She was somebody with segregated legs. She was somebody of charisma. She was somebody whose insides embraced worldly love. She was somebody. She was somebody of desperate laughs. She was somebody too fancy for loneliness. She was somebody who made love to fantasy. She was somebody who danced around reality. Because inside, she was simply a nobody.
My name is Jaquim McAllister. I am a senior journalism and mass comm major. And I will be reading an untitled poem written by myself today. No money for education, but they steady building up jails. They say never bite your tongue, but it's hard as hell for me to tell a kid not to steal, kill, and sell when they see their mama breaking her back just to make scraps, just to make a meal. Or when they've prayed so hard that their knees should be made of steel, or when they've cried so much that their tears can fill a well, or when they've hurt so deep that their skin should be made of braille so people can feel the pain that they endure every day. It ain't a fork big enough to stab the bullshit on your plate. Keep your head up, kid. We are going to heaven because we're living in hell.
My name is Jabria Parker. I'm a senior at Savannah State University, and I'm an English major. This poem is called My Jealous Heart. My generosity pours like a gourd, giving the water of life through the interconnected consciousness, the blind eyes, the deaf ears, twisted and conflicted with the hunger to do. More of what the earth in all its expanse exposed to its eyes, wanting to touch the very souls and fill its happiness, dancing like fingers, touching the skin of the precious lover. The happiness that is given only when one climaxes and peaks, the climax that can't be given by an empty soul, less act of lust, but knowing that heaven is now what you experience with every breath of cold, crisp air that fills your lungs. Completion. The heart beats on a sleeve as I dodge the arrows of pain, depression, and sorrow. As malicious intentions and crude words cause the struggle and strife, my heart drips but doesn't drain, rips but doesn't fade.
Hi, my name is Jeremy Little. I'm a junior here at Savannah State, and I'll be reading you my piece, You Look Pretty for a Black Girl. You look pretty for a black girl. Those words had sent me over the edge. What is that supposed to mean? Am I not pretty as is? Was I not pretty before you met me? If I was a white girl, would it even be a question? Last I checked, I was beautiful not because of my skin. Since when is black not pretty? You know what? I'm just gonna pick up my stuff and walk out. How dare he say that to me? What was he thinking? As if I could only be pretty because I'm not black. Is there some kind of stigma that I can't look good? Now that I think about it, he has always complimented me on things I have. That dress looks pretty on you. You make that purse look good. You look pretty for a black girl. Am I just another one of my things to him? An item to hang on his arm to boost his ego, like a nice ring or watch? Last I checked, I was always pretty. Even before I had my dark, silky skin, I was pretty. But then to make it as if it's just a piece of clothing I can put on every day? How rude.
You've just listened to poems by Candace Reynolds, Kiera Lewis, read by Candace Reynolds, Jaquim McAllister, Jabria Parker, and a work of prose by Jeremy Little.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yant, the director of the Right Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
I am Sarah Dillard, a sophomore majoring in civil engineering and technology at the Savannah State University. As a peer tutor at the SSU Writing Center, I bring you the Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day. Always start your paper with an attention grabber. A fact, quote, or question pertaining to the topic of your essay are commonly used.
The Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Hello and welcome back to The Writer's Way. I'm your host, Dee Dee Botticelli. No radio show is complete without a little drama and theatrics, and we just happen to have a bit of both for you. Our own professor of performing arts, Daryl Thompson, and 13 of his theater students came together to inspire you, as well as entertain you, with their rendition of a passage from Hill's novel, The Book of Negroes.
Mina Diallo was hired to keep a log of Negroes who had been loyal to the British. She had just been reunited with her husband, who was missing for 10 years.
I was given a message to spread around Canvas Town. Starting the next day, from 8 until 11 each morning, every Negro who spent a year or more behind British lines was welcome to line up at the Frances Tavern. Every man and woman will be given 2 minutes to explain themselves.
If you can satisfy me that you are of good moral character and have served the British for at least 1 year, you will be told which wharf to attend and what day to board what ship.
There'd be a more substantial inspection on the ships.
Any person who presents himself fraudulently will be turned over to the Americans.
The next morning...
We have months to do this. We can't possibly process all of you in 1 day. I'll take the first 30. Now move inside.
My job was to interview the Negroes and relay answers to the officers. Some were for places I'd never heard of, and I couldn't understand them. But for the most part, I was able to collect their information and explain what was written on their tickets. I felt that I was giving something special to the Negroes seeking asylum in Nova Scotia.
Mina, you must tell everyone the wharf where they're to go, the time to be there, and the name of the ship. Also, tell them what possessions they can bring. A barrel of food, a barrel of clean water, and a chest of clothing. You must say all of that. Understood?
I didn't tell him that the Negroes at Canvas Town didn't have barrels of food or chests of clothes.
Mina, we will process 30 each day for 2 more days. Then there will be no more tickets until mid-May.
Colonel Baker, I want to thank you for the pleasant room at the Holy Ground. But more importantly, thank you for letting Shakira stay with me. 10 years is a long time without a husband.
We can offer him a job cleaning the barracks to keep him busy. He should take it, because he's not going to be seeing a lot of you.
April 21st, 1783. The first 90 Negroes assembled on Murray's Wharf. They were rowed out to a few ships anchored in the East River. Colonel Baker, Captain Waters, and Mina were already on board.
Who are those two?
They are from the American Army. They're here to make sure no unauthorized Negroes are allowed to depart.
Sailors and officers moved around the deck, but the passengers were kept in the waiting area below.
Miss Diallo, you are to listen to us interview the refugees and use your scrivening skills in a neat, concise, and precise way. Write it down in that ledger.
These ledgers were to form part of a registration book listing all the Negroes carried to the British colonies at the end of the war. If the Americans chose to later press for compensation, the Book of Negroes would show who had left New York. Shakira and I would be going too.
Bring up the first 10.
Who are they?
Slaves and indentured servants.
But I thought...
We'll get around to evacuating the refugees in Canvas Town. But first, we register the property of the white loyalists.
Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Allen, he's mine. I acquired this Negro as an indentured servant, and I'm taking him to St. John. His name is George.
I wrote in the ledger, George Black, 35. Then I wrote the name of the owner or indenturer, Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Allen. In the final column, I wrote how he was freed, being taken from an indenturer. Freed by Lawrence Hawthorne as certified.
Hannah Palmer?
From her disconsolate face and the white man who stood beside her, I could see that nothing about this trip suggested freedom.
Miss Diallo, Hannah Palmer, 15, stout wench, Ben Palmer Frogneck, claimant.
Claimant?
It means he owns her.
We interviewed other Negroes, and none of them were indentured or enslaved, but the questioning became more rigorous.
How did you come to be free?
I ran away.
Can you prove that you served the British Army?
Yes, sir.
Do you have a certificate from the British military official proving service behind His Majesty's lines?
I has paper back.
What did you say?
I has paper back.
Miss Diallo, what is this man saying?
He has a paper in his bag.
For heaven's sake, then tell him to bring it to me.
Next was a young woman with a baby in her arms.
Harriet Simpson.
Harriet Simpson, 19.
I wrote what he said. Then came the physical description.
Just a word or two. Put stout wench.
I wrote it, but was disgusted with the term.
formerly the property of Winston Wakeman, Nancy Mum, Virginia, GBC.
That stood for General Birth Certificate. Then a strange thing happened.
My baby, Sarah, she was sired by a British captain, and I have my certificate.
No one thought it necessary to ask exactly how she served the British. Sarah, too, healthy child, daughter of Harriet Simpson, born within British lines.
Born 1694, Virginia.
How did you serve the British?
I deserted the rebel standard, and that was service enough. Born a slave, but I will die free.
The colonel was very wary of details, and the American inspectors were growing bored. So I dashed out the entry as I saw fit. John Cartwright, 89, tired out in one milky eye. Formerly owned by George Haskins, Virginia. Says he came behind British lines 3 years ago. No one asked if he had a certificate. He was allowed to stay.
That is all the Negroes for this ship.
Only 10 of them?
Most of the space is for the white loyalists and their property. We have 14 for the next ship.
Later that night, in bed with Shakira, I chatted on and on about what I had seen.
Not impressed. Slaves and free Negroes together in Nova Scotia? Some promised land.
I worked each day from dawn to sunset, and time passed quickly. For 4 days, we were rowed out to ships in the East River. 50 ships, nearly 600 men, women, and children were inspected. I like writing the Book of Negroes, recording how people had gained their freedom.
Miss Diallo, you must hurry. Just get the briefest information. Use the short phrases like stout wench, marks on face, stout fellow, ordinary fellow, worn out, incurably late.
I didn't care for the descriptions.
Fine child.
But I loved when people followed the movement of my hand as I wrote down their names. It excited me to imagine that 50 years later, someone might find an ancestor in the Book of Negroes and say, that was my grandmother.
Miss Diallo, I want you to go down to Canvas Town to advise the Negroes that another 17 ships are being made available in the North Hudson River.
We inspected and registered 34 people, every one of whom was an indentured servant.
Name?
Sarah Johnson. I'm 22 years old. Where are we heading?
Quiet. She's mine, a quadroon.
Sarah Johnson, 22, squat wench, quadroon, indentured to Donald Ross, formerly slave to Burgess Smith, Lancaster County, left him with the above Thomas Johnson, her husband. Keep moving. Ross has 5 more indentured servants with him.
Is indentured another word for slave?
No. You indenture yourself for your own free will, for a fixed period of time, in exchange for money, lodgings, and food.
After such a long journey to freedom, I couldn't imagine agreeing to that. A month later, 50 ships sailed from New York Harbor carrying more than 800 men, women, and children.
Today we are going out to the ship bound for St. John.
I looked up from the ledger. I found myself face to face with Rosette and her daughter. I wanted to jump up and hug her, but she did the tiniest shake of her head. We couldn't be caught.
Hurry up, Miss Diallo. If she's free, you can just put down that she's traveling on her own bottom.
Rosetta Walcott, 21. I am traveling on my own. I've been behind British lines for 6 years, and I have my certificate.
Put down stout wench.
Adrena Walcott, 8, daughter of Rosetta. Fine girl.
We have ships headed for Quebec, Germany, and England.
I envied the Negroes headed for England until I found out they were owned by British or Hessian military officers.
Next. Hurry it up. David, 10, likely boy. Germany's residence of claimant, Master General Kospoth. The boy goes with the general who got him from Philadelphia. The boy can give no account with whom he formerly lived.
The colonel made me write it that way, but David had spoken with me briefly. On board the ship, he told me that General Kospoth had made up with him and a number of other slaves belonging to a tobacco farmer.
Just keep it simple, Mina.
When will the end be?
Before the year is out.
Your host, Dee Dee Botticelli here, letting you know that we've come to the end of another show. Thank you for listening to The Writer's Way, a Right Attitude radio show. We hope you've enjoyed our episode on author Lawrence Hill. If you're interested in learning more about his work, please be sure to check out his website at www.lawrencehill.com. I wish to thank all of those who made this show possible, including Lawrence Hill, Professors Chad Ferries, Dustin Michael, Daryl Thompson, and Ryan Clark. I'd also like to thank QEP's own Adriana Oliveira, Lisa Yont, and Sierra Walton for their help in production, as well as WHCJ's Ike Carter and Grace Curry. I'm your host, Dee Dee Botticelli, looking forward to bringing you more Right Attitude shows. You can listen to this and our other radio shows at qep.savannahstate.edu. And remember, embrace your inner author. Special thanks to SSU Theater students Latasha Bell, Dennis Bennett, Blair Campbell, Kanisha Hicks, Marquavius Lampkin, Tydell Mosley, Samuel Napier, Kadarius Peoples, Kimberly Rivers, Camilla Shellman, Jessica Werner, Jonathan Whitehead, and Tyrone Williams.